Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Jerry Sweeney presents Live on Era in association with EmeraldConnection.net.
Live on Era, presented by Jerry Sweeney.
It was nice to hear Howard getting kind of excited and delighted that I was logging on and was going to be with you. He must have just remembered it was Wednesday. Howard, thank you very much indeed. Always nice to meet a fan. And you and Luna, have yourself a lovely Wednesday evening. I hope you're doing something nice, like listening to Live on Era or something like that. Good evening and welcome. Nice to have your company on this Wednesday. Where are we? We're at the 16th of October. I've got two. It's the program of the Johns this evening. I've got two guests for you. Both of them are called John. So the first guest you will meet in this particular hour is John Evoy. And John is the general manager of an organization called Grow Remote. It was set up back in 2018, and the idea was to promote working from home or remote working. And that was before the pandemic. And obviously it has grown pace. So we'll find out a little bit about the organization. John recently called for a body to be set up in Ireland to assist with helping people to work remotely and to try and encourage employers and employees to look at it as an option, because, as he says, there are social, economic and cultural benefits, and not to mention environmental benefits to working remotely. So we'll find out more about Grow Remote when I talk with John Evoy in the next few minutes. All right. John Gower is going to join me as well in the second hour of the program. And John is a Welshman. What's a Welshman doing on an Irish program? Well, steady on a second. He has written a fabulous book, which is called The Turning Tide. And it's about the Irish Sea. And there's a lot in the book about that side of the Irish Sea, as in Ireland, and that side of the Irish Sea, as in Britain. And I'm looking forward very much to my conversation, because if it's anything like the read that the book is, it will be fascinating. So that's John Gower, our second guest on the programme this evening. There you go. I've got some news for you as well. Nothing other than what's happening across Ireland, really. I have that for you. And I have some music that I will bring to you. Oh yes, last week I mentioned as well, didn't I, that the Irish Embassy in Madrid had advised me of some events which were taking place this autumn. I'm going to be giving you a rundown of those as well. So there might be something there that you might like. So either have the finger on the pause button to record it, or you can get a pencil and piece of paper, do it the old fashioned way, if you can't type fast enough. And you might be able to jot down some information about something or things that might be of interest to you in a number of areas across Spain over the next month or so. So that's coming up as well. Good news. Yes, I'm going to start with some good news. I always like to start with good news. So the train services have started running from the largest transport hub on the island of Ireland, and that is in Belfast. Oops, I forgot to turn off the phone. Well, silent the phone, silence the phone. And people don't start texting me until about 6 o'clock. Well, 5 to 6. On a Wednesday. It's gas. No. Anyway, I'm talking about Belfast and the largest transport hub on the island of Ireland. The first train to depart from Belfast Grand Central Station was the 8:05 a.m. Enterprise to Dublin Connolly on Sunday last, with just over 100 passengers on board. The £340 million station opened for bus services 5 weeks ago, but a range of safety checks had to be conducted and new signalling installed before train services could get underway. Larger than two football pitches, the station has 8 railway platforms and 26 bus stands. Translink, the Northern Ireland Transport Holding Company, which owns the station, has described it as a game changer, with the capacity to cater for 20 million passenger journeys per year. The transport hub is located on the Grosvenor Road behind the previous bus and rail stations servicing central Belfast. The Europa Bus Centre and Great Victoria Street train station, which have now closed, Stormont's Infrastructure Minister John O'Dowd was on board the first train to arrive at the station. The service from Portadown, which arrived at 9:15 a.m. on Sunday. All enterprise services to Dublin will now depart from Grand Central Station. A new hourly train service between Belfast and Dublin is due to start later this month and is being supported by €25 million from the Irish government. While 70% of the companies that worked on the project were from Northern Ireland, a Dublin-based firm did the glazing, and the glass was manufactured by a company in County Tipperary. So there you go. There's a good old injection of Irish workforce in there as well. I have a sneeze coming on. I hate that. But I'm doing something on the radio. Hang on. I'm glad you didn't hear that. sorry about that. So anyway, that's good news. I was in Belfast recently. I was on Grosvenor Road and I was on Great Victoria Street. But I didn't notice all the activity because I was concentrating, I suppose, on the driving. Yeah. But the next time I'm there, I must seek it out and have a look. In fact, yeah, I stayed over actually in Belfast as well. So I could have been going down and having a look at that. But anyway, I'll do that the next time that I'm there. Now, I said I start with good news, and that was good news. I suppose the next thing to do is to give you, not bad news, but it's bad news if you're Sinn Féin or a member of the Sinn Féin party, because George and I spoke last week on the G2 about a particular story about Michael McGonagall, the former press secretary in Sinn Féin. And in 2022, they had basically seen the back of him. And he was being investigated by police for alleged paedophilia, only for one of the party's most senior figures to then help McGonagall to gain employment at the British Heart Foundation. You may recall that we mentioned that there was a reference issued. All right. They did this, as I said, by giving a positive employer reference, which made no mention of the reasons behind his departure from Sinn Féin. Senior party figures tried to shift the blame to the charity, suggesting that it would have done more to vet McGonagall, even though the charity had gone to Sinn Féin's director of communications, who recommended him. Now, George and I spoke about that, and we said, you know, that story had been hanging around for about 2 or 2.5 weeks at that stage, and that it was suggested that there was more to come. And it wasn't necessarily more to come about that story. And there was enough of a hoo-ha about that. Then what happened was last Saturday night, one of the most, better known members, Sinn Féin members of Leinster House, of Dáil Éireann, resigned his position within RTE, within Sinn Féin. Sorry, Ger, will you get yourself a grip? And that was Brian Stanley. Now, he's also the chair, well, up to today, he was the chair of the Public Accounts Committee. That's a position that Sinn Féin holds. So now that he has left the party, he is going to have to, or he will be deposed of that. Now, the story behind that is that apparently there was an allegation made against him back in July or August of this year. That was investigated through the processes that Sinn Féin have for investigating internal issues. There was a counterclaim made at a later stage. And based on the counterclaim, Sinn Féin apparently told Brian Stanley that he should go to the Gardaí. They went a certain way along the process, the grievance and all of that. And basically what they were recommending at a point, Brian Stanley didn't want any hand, act or part in it. So he resigned from the party. That has led to calls from the opposite benches, i.e. the government parties and others, to know why Sinn Féin waited until he resigned from the party to send the details to the Gardaí. And this has all been going on for quite the last couple of days. Mary Lou MacDonald, the president of Sinn Féin, is under severe pressure, has had to make statements to the media, has had to make statements in Dáil Éireann. And that doesn't even stop there, because some back in December of last year, another high-profile senator who was a former or is a former Lord Mayor of Belfast had to resign from the party. At the time, it was decided, or it was said, that he was leaving because of mental health issues. However, it now turns out that he is the person behind the story that was leaked, suggesting that a party member had been sending unwanted and unsuitable texts to a 17-year-old male. And it has basically been suggested that Sinn Féin covered this up by the glowing references that and the glowing nice things that were said about him when he resigned. The person in question is Niall O'Donnelly. And he confirmed yesterday, just prior to Mary Lou MacDonald confirming in Dáil Éireann, that he was the person at the centre of the story that had been referred to the PSNI, but had that investigation had concluded and no offence had been committed according to the PSNI. So Sinn Féin is in a whole pile of hot water. That story is going to be maximised by all of the other parties and the independents, because I'd say we're very close to the dissolution of Dáil Éireann, and we're also close to the because of that then the election which will be called for either the 15th or the 22nd of November. The other night I got a text message to suggest that it may actually be the 22nd of November, but that hasn't been confirmed as yet. So there you go, that's the kind of shenanigans that's going on at the minute, and I think it's something that will be visited again, that particular Sinn Féin story. Anyway, let's get on with some music, shall we? Here's some music, some new music from the Saw Doctors. It's a song called I Love to Go a Wanderin'. Let's take a listen. Hope you enjoy.
I thought I'd live forever. Sure, I think most people do. When I was young, I knew it all. Now I haven't got a clue. Oh, sur le pont d'Avignon. That's going back a while. When I think of brother Nolan's class, he always makes me smile. But in my mind, I love to go wandering back in time to those golden autumn days. They bring a smile. Summer's life.
lost that sound, have they? No, they have not. I love to go a-wandering, is what it's called. All the way from County Mayo, that is the Saw Doctors. It's a pleasant evening here. I hope it is where you are as well. Thanks very much for tuning in to Live on Air. I forgot to tell you, but sure, you probably know at this stage, if you'd like to get in contact for any reason, you're more than welcome to do so. Our WhatsApp machine, the number for that is +34 645 996795, or you can send an email to studio@tre.radio. I'm going to take a break right now. Did you get your pencil and piece of paper for the details of what's coming up in the autumn? All right, well, that's coming up just after this. So be ready now. This won't be long.
Live on Air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
All right, the Irish Embassy in Madrid has advised me of some events taking place this autumn, and we'll start with the celebrations around Samhain or Halloween. Celebrations are underway this year in different parts of Spain as part of the IFACUS Irish Literary 2024. The Irish Studies Centre in the University of La Rioja will be hosting the 8th International Seminar on Halloween, Post-Human Intersections in Irish Literature, on the 28th and 29th of October. You can check out their website if you want more information on that. EFACIS is what you're looking for there. Now, the Madrid-based Irish dance group Irish Treble will be in concert on the 27th of October. That is on a Sunday evening, and it's going to be happening at Sala Galileo Galilei, together with guests to celebrate Samhain. And more information and how to buy tickets can be found if you just Google Irish Treble. It will come up. Now, you're encouraged as well to visit Tourism Ireland's webpage on Halloween for a wealth of information on the origins and celebrations of the festival. We'll do a little bit more on that on the programme closer to the time. Now, an evening with Dennis Rafter, the Art Nouveau building of the Sociedad General de Autores y Escritores at Calle Fernando IV. All right. It's Fernando the Sixth, I beg your pardon. It's number four, Calle Fernando the Sixth. We'll be hosting the actor and director, Dennis Rafter, on the 28th of October at 7 p.m. with a talk in Spanish about the influence of the great Irish storytelling tradition in his own work as actor, director and dramatist, as well as outlining his approach to the staging of plays by authors such as Shakespeare, Cervantes and Wilde. He will also describe the role of its inspiration in the writing of his plays on Santa Teresa, Nebrija and the Spanish War of Independence, and read some extracts from the plays. He will also be speaking of his latest book, El Secreto del Rey Laurie Lynch. It's free and it's open to the public until full capacity has been reached. So get in early if you want to go along there. Now, the Madrid Bloomsday Society will have their first gathering this autumn on Wednesday the 30th of October at 7 p.m. in the Ateneo de Madrid. They are looking for readers, musicians and singers to participate in their monthly meetings. So please email bloomsdaysociety@gmail.com if you're interested in taking part in any of those monthly meetings. That's the Madrid Bloomsday Society. The Valencian Irish Cultural Association has a range of activities lined up for the autumn, and you can check it out by visiting their social media pages. The Irish Studies Centre in the University of Vitoria, Iusk Cara, will be collaborating with the second edition of the Tartalo Symposium from the 4th to the 10th of November. The itinerary will include participation by Irish authors Sheila Armstrong and John Carlson, and their webpages have the full lineup if you want to check that out. Tartalo Symposium. Irish artists will be performing at the Festival Babieca Folk in Burgos and the Festival Etina y Folk in Vitoria from the 22nd to the 24th of November. November, so you've plenty of time to organise what you're going to wear between now and then. You can consult their web pages for information on the full programme as well. And finally, the Irish folk duo Limoncello, with singer-songwriter Laura Quirk and cellist Claire Kinsella, will be touring Spain during the month of October. For more information on locations, dates and how to buy tickets, please consult their website if you are interested in that. So there you go, just some of the events happening over the autumn. And thank you to Anne-Marie and the crew at the Irish Embassy in Madrid for sending that information to me. If you want to hear more about that, I'll give it a mention again next week on the programme. That's what it's, no, that's not what it's called. Change the World is what it's called. And it comes from Skanger. Yeah, Skanger, what a name. There's an 80s kind of a vibe to that, isn't there? Very much so. Right, a story that broke a little earlier on today. It's quite troubling and it's been updated since. But Gardaí believe that an 8-year-old boy reported missing earlier this year may have been killed over 2 years ago. Carmen Dernan from Dundalk, sorry, Drogheda in County Louth, was reported missing in August, and Gardaí say that they believe the boy is missing, presumed dead, and have upgraded the investigation to a murder inquiry. Apparently on the 30th of August, a missing persons report was filed at Drogheda Garda station in relation to the child. Gardaí were told that he was last seen in the town 2 days earlier. They issued a description of the clothes that Kieran was wearing and a picture of him when he was around 6 years old and an appeal for information. During the course of this inquiry, information came to light that led detectives to suspect that Kieran had been missing for more than 2 days. Gardaí said today, in spite of extensive inquiries, they have been unable to find Kieran or identify any information on his current whereabouts. They also say that they have not discovered any evidence that Kieran is alive and suspect he may have died violently. The investigation is being led by a senior investigation officer based at Drogheda Garda station. No arrests have been made. Gardaí also said that TUSLA, the Child and Family Agency, is cooperating with the investigation and sharing information with the inquiry team. Detectives are also checking that with schools that Kieran attended in relation to his attendance record and to establish a timeline of his last movements. They have not identified a potential crime scene, have not discovered a body or a clear indication as to where Kieran is and what happened to him. Gardaí say that there are people in the community with information who can help with the inquiry and have appealed for them to contact Drogheda Garda station. Yeah, as I said, it's a troubling story. It's a very unusual story, but the story broke this morning that the thrust of the investigation was changing, and again that story now differs, that they now believe that he may have died 2 years ago. Sad. All right, let's do a quick break, and after that I will be talking to my first guest on the programme. And my first guest this evening is going to be talking to me about Grow Remote. It's an organisation set up to promote the idea of working remotely. John Evoy is the General Manager. I'll be talking to him just after these.
Live on Air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Recently, I spotted an article about a group, a non-profit group, advocating for remote workers. And this group has called for a body to be set up to promote remote working in Ireland. It comes after the first meeting of an all-party group on remote working took place in Leinster House recently. The group is called Grow Remote. It was set up back in 2018 to promote remote working in Ireland, and the general manager of that is John Evoy, and he said that remote working could solve social, economic and environmental problems if it is done correctly. He said that having no commute not only reduces emissions but also allows people more time to invest in themselves. And although Grow Remote was set up before the COVID pandemic, Mr. Evoy said that remote working has become more prominent since 2020. He joins me via Zoom this evening. John, it's lovely to talk to you. How are you?
Very good, thanks, Ger. Looking forward to the conversation.
And me. If you're a remote worker, you're probably on this old Zoom machine a lot during the day, are you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's second nature now at this stage, but it's brilliant to get to connect with people all over the world at a click of a button.
Good. Why did you set this up back in 2018? Because at that stage, the idea of remote working was fanciful. It was science fiction more so than anything, really. And it was something that not a lot of people were considering, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Good question. So just to, I suppose, be clear, I only had the opportunity to join Grow Remote in about 2020 when it was already set up. Grow Remote was set up by a group of, very insightful volunteers before the pandemic. And it was based on kind of insight that, one of our colleagues, Tracy, would have done a lot of travelling via all the little towns in Ireland and seeing that the main streets and towns were boarded up and towns, villages were dying. And what could be done? And the usual answer was, there's no jobs around here anymore. But actually there were, and this is even pre-pandemic, there was quite a number of remote jobs that people could get and work from anywhere, probably with companies that most people didn't hear about. For example, GitLab is the biggest remote first employer in the world, and you know, it's got no head office. There's other companies like Automatic, Doist, and these are companies that people don't typically hear of, but you can. They're quite large companies. They're usually hiring, and you can get a really good job with them, a proper, you know, employment with your annual leave, your pension contribution, all that sort of stuff. We're not talking about the gig economy. We're not talking about self-employed. So people can get really good jobs and develop really good careers from anywhere. And that was even the case before the pandemic. And now it's just, you know, it's accelerated significantly.
I've had a conversation with a number of people over the last wee while who were visiting the country, and remote working comes up in the conversations quite a lot. And I always cite the recent diktat from Amazon, a major employer, saying, right, lads, party's over. You're all back in the office from January. If you don't want that, well, then you need to go and find something else to do. And that is starting to, I mean, if they can do that, that's going to give other employers an idea that, yeah, we should or could do this as well. Is that going to impact your campaign?
I'm not so worried about that initiative by Amazon. I think that Amazon or any other company, I suppose, are entitled to run their company whatever way they feel is best for them. And we kind of know from research that, like, remote working does offer companies some things that they don't get enough, the access to talent. Probably, you know, startups who are fully remote grow faster, you know, and so on. And we work, as well as working closely with remote employees, we work closely with a lot of remote employers. And every company has to find out what works best for them, whether it's in office, whether it's hybrid or fully remote. And we'd be really supportive of that. What we would say is that where we can kind of contribute to the employees' opportunities by developing the remote working ecosystem. So some of those people might not want to go back to the office. If there's a well-developed ecosystem, then they'll have a choice to get another job, a remote job, and they can live and work from wherever they want. And that's kind of the ideal that we're working towards. Yeah, so that you know, and as well as that, I think the point you made where Amazon kind of was indicated that, oh, if you don't make it back to the office, then you can go and find another job. There would have been like some rumors that, you know, in a way it was like a covert voluntary redundancy scheme.
Okay. You know, so right.
It's a way of like people who don't, you know, cutting the staff numbers a little bit.
Can you do anything remotely? Because, you can't be a postman remotely. You can't be a bus driver remotely, but you could be a broadcaster. Because here I am sitting in my back room in County Clare, broadcasting to millions of people across Spain and across the world. But, you know, is there anything really outside of those ones that you can see? Like a barista probably can't be, a barman can't be working remotely, but pretty much anything that's office-based you can. Can't you?
Yeah, pretty much anything that's office-based. Again, it depends on the operating model of the company, but whether it is finance or communications or HR or legal or just general management, all of those things can be done from anywhere. You know, anywhere there's good internet connection and people have the technology. So, yeah, I think it's important that I think the world is beginning to realise that work is not a place, it's what you do.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. And it's so not...
We used to always go to work. And even when there was the back to the office kind of movement after the lockdown, after COVID, some people were saying going back to work. And like that was infuriating for people who were working hard all the time. Right. They weren't going back to work. They were going back to the office.
Some of the advantages then of working remotely, because in the introduction I said that you were saying that if it's done properly, you know, it can solve social, economic and environmental problems. So let's go through those. What do ye say are the big pluses?
Yeah, so I suppose just to give one or two examples under each of those headings, even though they're completely intertwined, you know, from a social perspective, you know, if people are spending a lot of time commuting, for example, they've got less time to spend locally, they've less time to spend with their family. We have research that shows, for example, that people who used to commute but don't do it anymore invest an average of 3 hours a week into either themselves, their own well-being or activities, or into community activities like volunteering, whether that's coaching the under-10s team or participating in Tidy Towns or whatever. Different for everybody. You know, and that's got a huge impact on communities. And also on their own well-being. We know that, like, sitting in the car all the, like, for lots of hours isn't great for anybody. Economically, then, I mean, we're talking about kind of economics at a very local level. The difference that, like, spending your money locally in the local coffee shop or in the local grocery shop makes, as opposed to, you know, spending it in a petrol station halfway to the nearest big city. And we know we've stats on that as well. And I think that for every three good remote jobs that are in a community, they sustain another two locally. So that's, you know, the ratio of how they help, you know, the coffee shops or the whatever it is, the local businesses to thrive. And that's really important. I suppose on that, you know, there would have been research last year from Galway University and the Western Development Commission. And I could be wrong now, but I think, like, the average salary of these remote jobs that we were talking about was up around the 50,000 mark. So they're good mid-career jobs. You know, very often it's people in earlier career jobs. People like to go into the office. Employers like to have graduates come in and learn by osmosis from the people who are there. We're not saying that's the only way to do it, but that definitely this seems to be a trend. So the remote jobs then are more mid-career jobs, and that maybe people who have got all that experience and maybe have families and want to, like, not be spending time commuting so they can drop the kids to school and still do their day's work.
It also it takes pressure off of people as well, doesn't it? You know, having to iron five shirts in the week and, you know, having to have the washing done on a Saturday or a Sunday. You can sit at home and you can be in your T-shirt or you can, you know, there's that element of it.
There's that element of it too. Yeah, no, definitely it gives people a lot more flexibility. I suppose sometimes we can conflate the idea of a fully remote job and a flexible job. Because some remote jobs are, like, quite structured. You know, for example, you could be sitting home, a neighbour of yours in County Clare could be doing sales support or customer service to the American market. They start at 5 p.m. Irish time, they work until 1 p.m. and they've got their three breaks. And, like, you know, it's very structured and, you know, they can only take their breaks at that time or somebody else is covering them and stuff. So not all remote jobs are completely flexible. Not all remote jobs mean you can drop the kids or whatever. But some of them do. I think one of the biggest things that remote work has done is kind of helped change management styles. So from an employer's performance management perspective, like, you have to be able to agree with your employees, what are they going to get done? You know, what's the output? It's not like how long are you sitting at your desk. You know, presenteeism isn't a thing. Okay. Coming in from 9 to 5 and sitting in front of your desk isn't getting the job done. Mm. Getting the job done means, you know, 100 sales this month or 100 whatever publications or whatever your targets are in your job. So therefore, it gives the employer and the company a lot of comfort. Once that work is getting done, they don't really have to worry about, are you dropping the kids? Or are you having a cup of tea? Or are you putting on the wash? And it's also really easy to see. Like, it's easy to count. It's like, you know, so there's no hiding place when your work is managed like that.
And, of course, the environment and the benefits to it, self-explanatory, because you're not sitting in a car with, you know, pumping out emissions on the M50 or the M7 or whatever the case might be. You know, there's also less workload for trains and buses and all sorts of things like that. So that's kind of self-explanatory as well. What are the drawbacks for somebody that works from home exclusively?
Yeah, so there is. And we'd always say that, like, remote work won't happen by itself and that there's lots of challenges that need to be overcome in order to, I suppose, maximise that benefit for communities or for the country. And some of those challenges are, like, very first, when Grow Remote got up and running, the very first challenge we spotted was that a lot of remote workers could be isolated if they didn't have a structure in place, you know, and you don't want to be working at home all day on your own and then not interacting with other people at all. So we set up which is probably our most successful initiative. It's what we call our chapters. It's where groups of remote workers meet up on a regular basis in their locality, offline. And it can be for as simple as having a pint, or it could be a coffee or a breakfast, or maybe doing an activity such as kayaking or tennis or table tennis or whatever, but where they kind of recreate what it'd be like to be in contact with a few work colleagues. The only difference is, you know, all those colleagues aren't from the same company. They're just whatever remote workers are in the location.
Right.
So that counteracting the isolation was a big challenge that some people had to overcome. Now, it suits some people, depending on your personality type.
Yes.
And then another one would have been, I suppose, the visibility of the jobs that we were talking about. I mentioned some companies there at the start. And, you know, if you're a local person and you're just looking for a remote job, unless you're really deep into this kind of space, you'd never think of Googling for those companies or looking for those companies' career pages. And one of the problems is that, like, fully remote companies, like, they have access to talent wherever they're hiring. And that could be all over the world, or it could be, like, in time zones, or it could be in the EU. The companies would often hire anywhere in the EU, for example. And they've got access to all this talent. So they'll never advertise their jobs on the local radio station or on, you know, on the local spar notice board.
Yeah.
So you have to go and try and find those jobs. So one of the things we work on is like kind of making that pathway for the job seeker to wherever those jobs are, which is on like multiple career pages all over the world. But it's trying to highlight that and signpost that and have them all pointing into one direction. That's a problem that we try and solve as well.
Okay. Talk to me a little bit about the meeting that took place in Leinster House recently, an all-party group. I presume you mean all parties in the Dáil or in the Shannon and in the Oireachtas. You know, they got together. What was the purpose of that, and what was the driving force behind it, and were there any outcomes?
Yeah, so we were delighted to see this happen. It was something that was been discussed for quite a while. I mean, we would have held an event in the Dáil for all TDs and senators last May.
Okay.
Kind of, it was just a discussion for everybody around harnessing the potential for remote work for the country. And then all of the attendees of that were invited to stay involved, you know, as we take it to the next step, as this group was set up. And we are very happy to say that there was like about 10 TDs and senators from all parties and some independents who came along, who really see, I suppose, the value of remote work and potentially for the people in their areas, and how, you know, they, by helping us to highlight these opportunities, can help land jobs in every community across the country. But as well as that, I suppose, these people are the legislators, and that there are, like, there's a very important role for our legislators in making sure this stuff happens even more going forward. And some of the things I'm talking about there might seem like minor, more nuanced things, but like, I'll give you an example, Jared. From an income tax perspective, if you're an employee and you travel from work, you're allowed to get travel expenses from your place of work. But if you get travel expenses from your home, it's meant to be taxed as a benefit in kind. But that's not, you know, so like, that's not now clear if you're a remote worker and your work is your place of home. Mm. So there's things that, like, things in employment law, things that like the Department of Public Expenditure or Department of Finance will have to look for. There's things that, you know, the Workplace Relations Commissions will have to look for. And it's just that, I suppose, we were working in an office. We were working in offices for the last 100 years, and it was forever evolving. Like, remote work is still a relatively new thing, and the little nuanced things across employment law and and taxation haven't really caught up. Hmm. And that's why our legislators are really, really important in this.
Is there any section of the community that wouldn't like to see this happen? And I'm thinking primarily of property developers who would be building, you know, large offices and office blocks in major cities like Limerick and Belfast and Derry and Dublin. And, you know, would they be kind of lobbying against this notion, or is there enough to go around?
So I assume there are groups of people who have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo of how it has been for many generations. I don't have any direct evidence that there are people lobbying against what we're saying.
Okay.
I think it's because it's obviously a really good thing. I think, you know, from a developer's perspective, you know, I mean, if there's any initiatives that haven't started yet, like, it would be ideal if, you know, and I know it takes everything into planning and city planning and everything, but we do have a housing crisis. So if we could build more houses instead of more offices, I think it'd be fantastic. And I know it's not as simple as that. And as well as that, we always say, like I've said already, you know, it's up to each company to decide what they need to do that's best for their company. Because we know remote working won't work for employees or for communities unless it works for the employers first. Yeah, but I also think there is a kind of once in a lifetime opportunity to kind of reimagine what our cities could look like. You know, is there going to be more green spaces, less traffic? You know, people who are working in offices are the people who live close to those offices, and so on. So, you know, there's a way that this works for really everybody.
Okay. What shape should this body that you're calling for be? Should it have representatives of the legislator? Should it have representatives of employers, employees? You know, what kind of ideas have you got around this?
So I suppose, you know, there's a number of formats that I could take, but really the principle behind what we're talking about is like very kind of deep collaborative work from people who are across, you know, across government parties, across government departments, agencies, you know, employers, employees, all stakeholders who kind of share the vision for, you know, what I've been trying to describe there about how this could really, you know, maxim out its potential for the good of everybody. And I mean, even like getting those people in a room, like, because each of those people will bring to the table whatever, you know, they can do, whether it's like operational or strategic or legislative. So it's not straightforward. We would be very, very mission driven, like where we'd see, you know, if we solve the problems of remote work, that, you know, this can work for everybody, people, planet and profit. But we don't really care who does it.
Okay.
Like if we're the agency who grows and we help grow remote and we be a big player in it, then brilliant. But equally, like say for example, like I think that the IDA is probably the best in the world at doing what it does, like about bringing foreign direct investment to Ireland. And, you know, that's all about landing jobs, you know. So maybe it's their expertise that instead of bringing the companies to build an office or a factory here in Ireland, they're just landing the jobs that are already available around the world here in Ireland. So, yeah, I'm not so worried about who does it. It's getting done. Yeah.
The fact that it's looking very likely that it's going to be an election year, is there any opportunity there for you?
I don't know. I suppose if, you know, if there's people in different constituencies listening to this across Ireland, that, you know, and politicians come to their door, it would be good if they asked them, you know, what do they think about remote work, or what can they do to help remote work for whatever constituency or community they are in. I know one of the things we focus on is like there's a number of ways of looking at remote work. So remote work, and you can either like attract people who've already got the remote jobs to a locality and come and live, and that's really good for repopulating an area. But what we find is even more powerful is trying to land those remote jobs for local people. So whatever resources are needed to make those jobs visible, maybe there's and accessible. So that means maybe the local people to do some training to get those specific jobs. So there's a lot in it. I think just keeping it on the agenda, because obviously during the pandemic, remote working was on the tip of everybody's tongue, and it's easy for things to fall off, you know, the agenda, because the next important thing comes along, in fairness, you know, and whether that's the housing crisis or whatever people are worried about right now, that'll be what's at the forefront of politicians' mind. So we've a little bit of a job to do at keeping this at the forefront of the politicians' mind.
All right. If somebody wants to find out more about you or maybe even join the club, how did they do that?
Yeah, so basically the easiest thing is to go to our website, broremote.ie, and that's where, like, whichever kind of stakeholder you are, whether you're an employer looking for training for your team, or you're an employee who'd like to go to one of our community events, or you're just curious about the whole thing, that's the way to find it all.
I said at the start, it's a non-profit group. So I presume you're doing other work along with doing this, or is this your full-time job?
No, this is my full-time job.
Oh, good.
No, we've got some funding. We're a social enterprise. And I suppose from the non-profit perspective, what that means is that, like, any profit we make from our work, you know, we can't give that out to shareholders or to staff. Yeah. But we can pay salaries, and we have a great team of 8 people. And our primary, I suppose, way of generating income that goes to all the impact is through training companies in this, like, leading remote teams or leading hybrid teams. And there's still a demand for that there.
All right. I let you back to doing what you do. GrowRemote.ie is the website. John Evoy, general manager of that organization. Thanks a million for talking. It's fascinating. And you have my contact details. Anything I can do for you in the future, please do.
Thank you, Jeff.
Push that open door, because I'm more than happy to help in any way I can. Right, here is the piece of music that I was about to play when John finished, but unfortunately I had to abandon it because that jingle was playing and I needed to stop that more so than stop this. It's a song that's called 8 Hours. I thought it would be appropriate to play after I spoke with John. Here's Maria Kelly.
It's in the not knowing if I'm coming or going, and if only I
doesn't she? That's a lady by the name of Maria Kelly. Hey, what are the girl of the Kellys? 8 Hours is what that is called. Tommy Quill, a friend of mine going back many, many, many years when he and I were both young, sent me an email out of the blue to say that he was tuned in the one night that we had some issues. Tommy, lovely to hear from you. I hope that you're well and making the best of everything, and nice to have your company this evening. So thanks a million for the email. I'm extremely bold. I haven't been in touch in a long, long time, but we'll do at some point in the near future. Aye, if there was only 48 hours in the day, wouldn't it be smashing? Although I'd probably fill them as well. Right, my next guest is standing by. A quick little jingle, then we'll go and have a quick chat. Might be more than a quick chat. We're going to talk about a fabulous book.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
The Turning Tide has been described as a hymn to a sea passage of world historical importance, combining social and cultural history, nature writing, travelogue, and politics. Welshman John Gower charts a sea which has carried both Vikings and saints, invasion forces, royals and rebels, writers, musicians, and fishermen. We're talking about the Irish Sea, and John Gower joins me via Zoom this evening on the programme. John, you're very welcome, and thank you for joining me. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. And yourself?
Good, thank you. You have the distinct honour, I hope you'll take it as an honour, of being the first Welshman on Live on Era. So you're welcome doubly on that one.
I am turning into a balloon as I swell with pride.
Eloquent as always. John, this book is lovely. It's about, when I was told it was about the Irish Sea, I thought to myself, so what can you write about the Irish Sea, really? But what you've done is you've brought together some stories that all hinge around the Irish Sea. But before we start talking about that particular tract of sea or water, let's dispel the myth. The Irish Sea is not what we consider the Irish Sea to be, as in like the entire length of water between Ireland and Britain. Sure, it's not.
No, it sort of subdivides, really. And it's hard to understand how you can subdivide the sea, which is just a fluid, massive moving water. But of course, if you look to the place where what we call the Irish Sea broadens out and joins, if you like, the wide ocean, that is technically called the Celtic Sea. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what I'm looking at in the main in my book is that stretch of the Irish Sea between Wales and Ireland, between the facing coasts of Wales and Ireland. And technically, if you pick up a nautical chart, that is marked, very interestingly, as St. George's Channel. Mm. So you've got a stretch of water between Ireland and Wales named after the patron saint of England, which reminds us that, you know, seas are political. They're ways of actually people moving around freely, but sometimes not so freely, and they can be borders. And then, as you suggest, as the thing which is loosely imagined as the Irish Sea drifts northwards then beyond Northern Ireland and beyond the western shores of Scotland, it turns into the North Channel, which then, of course, then broadens out into the North Atlantic. So, yes, on one hand, it's an amorphous mass of sometimes blue water for the weather's nice, sometimes darker water, but it's all in little zones and it's all controlled by the forces of tide and current, and it's forever in a state of flux. It's always changing, it's bringing drift in with it, it's bringing flotsam, jetsam, you know, and so on.
Mm. I know the answer to this. I think everybody will know the answer to it. But will you tell us, in your opinion, and maybe from the pages of the book, the importance of the Irish Sea? Why is it so important?
Well, it's been important, not just in modern times, but historically important. There's a Welsh historian called Gwyn Alf Williams, and he described it as a Celtic superhighway. It wasn't just taking people. I mean, there was a trade across the Irish Sea, but it was also taking ideas. And I suppose you couldn't take a bigger idea to export from one place to another than Christianity. And of course, that trade in saints, the famous ones, famous ones being Patrick and St. David, were just figureheads for a much larger exchange of saints. And my favourite one is a bit of a tongue twister. He's called Madomnoc of Ossory. And he was one of the disciples of St. David. So he was living on the southwestern tip of Pembrokeshire. And he was a fantastic beekeeper. He was one of the best beekeepers ever. And one day he decided to leave the monastery and go to explore the world. And he got a little boat, and often these stories in those days often involved a little boat, and he set off for Ireland. And as these stories often are as well, it doesn't happen to him once, but twice, but three times. And every time he leaves, The reason he can't actually leave Wales is because the bees follow him. So he goes out into open water, and he's got these swarms of bees, and he's thinking, oh no, I can't go any further because I will be depriving my fellow monks of honey. But then with David's blessing, he goes off and finally gets to the coast of Ireland and ends up in Ossory. He sets up his beehives there in Ireland. The bees thrive. And in turn, he becomes the patron saint of beekeepers. So, you know, there's that exchange. And when I began looking at the book, I was thinking, so what helps these people move around? It's not just that there are boat building skills, and there are also the currents which move in a particular direction. And it was a strange bit of luck, really, that when I started writing the book and I was thinking, what on earth am I going to say about the connections that make sense today? And at that very point, a walrus, this lovely, big, not, you know, a mammal of cold northern waters, turned up in the seaside town of Tenby in Pembrokeshire. Mm-hmm. And it started to spend its time just lolling around, being photographed by tourists. And that walrus had come from Valentia Island off the Kerry coast. So it had followed a set of currents which are used by the grey seals of the east coast of Ireland. They come across to Wales and then they move on. They move on to places like Brittany, sometimes as far as the northern coast of Spain and Galicia. And those currents, if you start to look at them, taking seals and sea mammals, are the same sort of currents that would have helped Welsh saints be exported as little cults to Cornwall and to Brittany. And then, of course, the currents in the other direction also help. And when I began to dwell on it, I was thinking, I wonder what more I can find out about walruses. Well, there have been lots of sightings of walrus in Ireland over the years. And there have been lots of sightings of things like walruses in Wales. But sometimes they turn out to be mermaids. Or are they actually mermaids just pretending to be walruses? Who knows with these things? But anyway, I was just interested to know why then walrus ivory became an important commodity. Well, of course, before the Moors brought elephant tusks across the Mediterranean, walrus ivory was an important commodity. So the Vikings, who established a very important centre in Dublin, if you went to the excavations there, you would find shards of ivory. And of course, then that was sometimes used to produce beautiful pieces of art. The famous chess set that was found by a crofter in Scotland, where the individual items were carved out of walrus ivory. The bishops, or rooks, were berserkers, these crazy Viking warriors who would ingest hallucinogenic mushrooms before they went off to battle. Right. And, of course, there's a political thing about that, even that chess set as well, because part of it resides in a museum in Scotland and part of it resides in a National Museum in England. So the politics of these things come in, and I was thinking, oh, this is going really well, but I'm mainly now writing about Ireland and the Vikings in Ireland and the walrus tusks. And then I found out that a medieval king in Wales called Hywel Dda, if you did something excellent in court, he would reward you by giving you something called a tawlbwrdd. And the tawlbwrdd was, interestingly enough, a sort of prototype chess set with the pieces made out of ivory.
That's incredible. Incredible. Before we go any further in relation to what's in the book, why did you write it? Where did the little seed come from that grew into this?
Well, strangely, there was a European project called Ports Past and Present. And what they were trying to do was to find ways of linking up ports around the Irish Sea, particularly around St. George's Channel.
Okay.
So they're looking at ways of linking up Dublin and Holyhead, Rosslare, Fishguard and Pembroke Dock. And I was thinking, okay, well, that's a map to begin with. And I was then, and they were quite keen to explore things like celebrating the heritage of these ports. So that, let's say, people coming through Holyhead, and Holyhead has been long been an important point, a conduit point for for people moving from Ireland into not just Wales, but into Britain and beyond.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other way. Well, sometimes people just pass through. They don't actually think, oh, what's in Holyhead? So part of the idea was to try and encourage people to think of these places as possible stayovers. So when I looked at the map, I was thinking, what's common about all of these that I know a little bit about? And part of the answer was staring me right in the face. All of them are really close to fantastic wildlife sites. Obviously, the Pembrokeshire ports are not far from some of the most spectacular seabird colonies in the world. And in fact, if you go from Pembroke Dock to Ross Lair, you will go past the island of Grassholme, and passengers will see it. It looks half black and half white.
Right.
It's a basalt rock, so it's dark volcanic rock. But in summer, half of it is startling white because of the gannets that you find there. So gannets are, you know, huge birds. You don't have to be a bird watcher to recognize a gannet.
Yeah.
It's got a 6-foot wingspan. It's a startling laser white, and the tips of its wings look as if it's been dipped in black ink. So then I thought, well, I wonder if that's so. Pembrokeshire's easy, and I know the Pembrokeshire Islands because I've worked on them. I first went to work on them when I was 14. So
okay,
that would be an easy bit of research, really, because I know about them. Then, of course, I was actually looking at Holyhead. Well, as the ferries leave Holyhead, you see a big hump of rock called South Stack. And if you look really closely, you will see guillemots and puffins, seabirds in serried ranks along the cliff edges there. So that sort of would cover wildlife areas close to the Welsh ports. In southern Ireland, in Wexford, you can get to probably one of the most important colonies of terns in Ireland, at Our Lady's Island. They're not just you know, the commoner terns, but also the rarest seabird in Europe is found there. It's the roseate tern. And interestingly, of course, the roseate terns that occasionally nest on Our Lady's Island don't always nest there. They sometimes cross the sea to Wales and nest in Cemlyn. So you've got, if you like, a population, really, of these really rare birds sharing the coasts of Ireland and Wales, and underlining the fact that if we're going to protect birds, we have to protect them in consort with other people. So then, having looked at the map, I was thinking that just leaves Dublin. And Dublin, of course, is famous. Dublin Bay is famous as being a place full of Dublin Bay prawns, langoustines. It's also an important bird feeding area. But the story in Dublin was even easier to tell, because Brent geese, which come in their thousands to Dublin Bay, have done so historically because they like a particular plant called zostera, or eelgrass. It used to grow in profusion in Dublin Bay. That profusion has reduced year on year, so that there are just a few patches left in Dublin Bay. But the birds still come in. And what they've done now is they've changed their feeding habits. So they feed on grass verges, public parks, and so on. They stay overnight near North Bull Island. And if you're lucky in the morning, you can get on the bus, the early bus that takes the late night workers or revelers home and the early workers to work. And if you go to North Bull Island, you can stand on a wooden bridge which connects the mainland with a point of land jutting out into Dublin Bay, and wait for the birds to rise. And someone said, if you're lucky, they will fly literally over your head, so you can hear the siss of the wind in the primary wings of their feathers. I was thinking, well, that would be brilliant. That would justify getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and going, you know, fairly blearily out to North Boyle Island. And that morning they did. They were coming, so you could actually hear the breath of their wings, as you like,
wow,
before they then formed skeins and fanned out over the city. So they would be going out all over the place. And I think that, you know, when I spoke to people, they feel very possessive about this. It's a way of marking autumn and winter. But the only thing the Brent geese can't cope with is one of the newer aspects of life in Dublin and other modern cities, which is astroturf. So
really?
Obviously some of them have obviously tried to land on rugby pitches and found out that they can't really graze on plastic. But it's just a lovely way of saying there is actually fantastic wildlife to be seen right in the heart of a modern European city.
One of the great things about presenting this programme is talking to people like yourself who just educate me on things that I didn't even know about our capital city or various parts of Ireland, because I never heard that story. But as it happens, I have been in Dublin quite a lot recently, and I will be again in the future. And I must do that, get up early and go out there and just experience that. Is there a particular time of the year?
They come in the autumn, October into March. And the nice thing is, I mean, you don't actually have to go to Northwell Island. There are other places. I'll tell you what, I'll drop you a line. There are lots of places. Okay. And that's the nice thing, really. And they get acclimatised to dogs and walkers and so on. But they never become tame, of course. They're still wild birds. And then when the instinct is there, and they sense the widening light in northern climes, they leave again because they breed a long, long way away.
Okay. In the introduction, I did say that there was social and cultural history in there as well. And as I was looking through the titles of the chapters early on when I was reading the book, I happened upon one in relation to the Dublin Docks, or the Dockers of Dublin, which is chapter 11. And when I was reading that, it really reminded me, parts of it reminded me of a kind of a Sean O'Casey play, you know, things that we grew up reading about and listening to. And you know that it's true, but when you see it in a book like this, you know, talking about the dockers and they're standing and they're waiting to be picked for a day's work, and sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But it dawned on me that I suppose that could have been called the Dublin, Liverpool, Holyhead, you know, Pembroke dockers, because it went on everywhere that time, didn't it?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that underlines the importance of these ports for maritime trade. And I suppose the other story that it tells, which we can see nowadays, is just how that very busy life, the employment of hundreds, sometimes thousands of men, which then allowed them to sustain their families.
Yeah.
That's all pretty much gone, really, because, you know, technology changes, and now it's big container cargo that moves around from, as you say, Liverpool, Glasgow, Belfast, Dublin, you know, the Rosslare at the moment, which is building up more and more ferry connections all the time. But of course, the other thing is about, as you know, because you go to Dublin and know Dublin, you don't have to go very far to find someone who will be a repository of great stories.
Yes.
So all I had to do was find some old dockers, get them to take me around, and then write down some of the things they said. And one of the things I really loved was the names they had for the dockers. And that's true for not just for dockers, for all, you know, industries, coal mining in Wales, you know, whatever it is, and there's always like a fantastic lexicon of names. And I was actually thinking, okay, well, I've got all these names, but you can just arrange them, really, put them into some sort of form. And I actually found that some of them were fairly fruity: Big Apple, Little Apple, and Crab Apple. There was a man called Remy Mata who worked along the Bombardier. Then there's a man called Two Thumbs Murphy.
That's right.
Who is presumably rather clumsy. The Man from Laramie, Buckets of Blood, The Gannet, and Saltbox O'Connor. Now, some of them, you could work out why these men were so called, because Spittin' Pint, Boxer Elliot, Fatser Curry, Baldo McCauley. Well, they're people you can actually say, well, he's got no hair, he's got a bit of weight on him and all that shit. But then there's another one who was explained to me. There's a man called The Bleeder who was apparently the whitest man who ever lived.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether he ever was the whitest man who ever lived, but there's that colour that comes from that. And as you say, I mean, there are those pictures of the men standing in the morning at what they would call the reed, and the names would be read out of those people who would be lucky enough to have a day's work. The people who were reading out the names had extraordinary power, you know, and obviously they would favour often family members.
Yeah.
So you had to work extra hard to curry favour with some of them. And then, of course, you've got these other little bits of detail which come in, which suggest just how hard it was for the people working in the connecting ports. One of the chaps I spoke to was saying about how one day they actually went to explore a Russian ship. And on the Russian ship, there were footprints of people who were working barefoot in really cold climes in somewhere like Russia. So that gave you an idea of how tough it was for people loading the ships. And then, of course, offloading the ships was really hard. They weren't actually having everything in neat packaging. The people who were actually taking coal off the ships coming into, say, Dublin, were doing it with big spades, and they were moving tons of coal physically. So when we talk about how difficult it was and how bad it was and injurious to health for coal miners, well, the people also moving the coal out of the holds of ships were also facing up to really difficult testing conditions. It was very, very hard work indeed.
Mm. Going back just very quickly to the nicknames, there was one there that I loved, and you said that it wasn't just in Dublin that the name would apply, but also to dockers in Limerick or in Liverpool and Glasgow and other places, and that was the diesel fitter. And it was to reflect the fact that somebody used to liberate some of the stock that they were, that they were carrying, and he'd say, "Yeah, diesel fitter."
Yeah, that is a classic story.
It is.
I've heard it said about Liverpool and Dublin, and I'm sure it's told about Belfast and all the rest of it. But when you then scratch under the surface, that story suggests is just, oh, clothes for the wife, yes? That. But then when you actually look at what sort of goods did go missing in Dublin, in one year, here's a list of some things that went missing. Ammunition, lead ingots, liquid mercury. You can't imagine that being something you'd want to take home to the wife.
That's right.
Then you've got 81 rolls of wallpaper, 15 suits, 25 lamb carcasses.
Yeah.
They're not things you can slip under your jacket now, are they?
No.
And then, of course, things like quicksilver. What would possess someone to want to steal mercury? Because it's literally something that would slip between your hands. So, yeah, it's that sort of colour as well. I mean, there's the big story of industrial change, and it actually says how it reminds us that, stuff has been moving back and forth along this waterway for a long time. It might be leather hides coming from Ireland, but the coal that was coming from small Pembrokeshire coal mines goes back many, many years. And, of course, there was a trade with the continent. And so it's a way of internationalising places. They connect with communities very similar to themselves.
You've also got a nice chapter on women of the sea. Tell us about the women of the sea.
Well, you can feel as if, women are underrepresented because women weren't actually, very prominent. They weren't the sailors and they weren't the captains very often. But I was thinking, well, there are some unsung heroines here that really deserve to be known better. So on the Welsh coast, there was a marvellous, fiery, redoubtable woman called Cranogwen. And she set up a school for sailors in a place called Llangrannog. And once I'd started to read up about her, I knew about her because recently they've been collecting money to erect a statue to her. So I knew about that. But then I found out that there were other ones. Ellen Edwards, who ran a school, a maritime school in Carnarvon. She educated hundreds of sailors over the years. And when she was teaching, there wasn't a place to examine sailors in Wales at all. So they had to go across to Dublin to actually sit the exams. And she, Ellen Edwards, was therefore written about in the Dublin papers. There was this woman who was passing on the skills of the sea to people in mainly North Wales, and then they were going across to Ireland to do their exams.
Right,
and of course, that sort of thing reminds you that there are always untold stories because for every sailor who goes to sea, there is a family left on shore.
Mm.
For every sailor who dies at sea, there is a family left bereft of that income. And that actually sort of did then encourage me to look at, so what provisions were made for someone like Ellen Edwards when her husband, who was a master mariner, died. Well, basically, they had to have the what was then the civic equivalent to a whip round. Okay. You know, they would get the town would give them a pension, but that didn't happen for everyone. So it also reminded you of, you know, if you don't have that lifeline of someone travelling overseas and coming back safely, then, you know, whole communities are disrupted.
Absolutely.
And of course, the sad downside of this is that the history of the Irish Sea is littered with shipwrecks, you know, big ships going down, smaller ships. You know, the sea has its temper. And it's anger.
She does.
And it can claim a lot of lives as well.
You speak about everything that we have talked about with great confidence and great knowledge. So I'm taking it that you knew a lot maybe about this area and about the importance of the Irish Sea prior to getting stuck into this. But firstly, a two-part question. Firstly, how long did you spend working on it? Or have you always been working on it and just put it together finally with a few other bits? The second part of that is there anything that you learned in putting this together that kind of wowed you, that made you say, wow, I didn't expect that?
Well, I'll take them in order, really. I wasn't an expert on the Irish Sea when I started this book, and I wouldn't claim to be an expert on the Irish Sea now. It's bigger and more complex and more wonderful, really, than you know one lifetime allows you to understand.
Okay.
But what I set out to do in going to look at wildlife sites, I actually learned quite a lot about myself, because I was trying to underline how anyone could get to these places. So I'm in my 64th year now. I'm overweight. I have arthritis in both knees. I don't walk very well. So I decided I would actually prove that an overweight man in his middle 60s could get to these places by push bike. So you can get a very reasonable ticket to take your bike across to Ross Lair. You can then cycle within half an hour from Ross Lair to Our Lady's Island. And you were saying about sort of what, you know, things that are amazing. If you go to Our Lady's Island in the middle of summer, when you've got this cacophonous, screeching mass of birds, which are only there for a brief time, and they're called sea swallows. And they're called sea swallows because they're these lovely long tail feathers, and they're both elegant and raucous. And that is actually, you know, just a half hour's cycle ride away from the
Ross Lair.
You know, the busy Europort at Ross Lair. In terms of wonders and how astonishing things are, well, I would have to say that the longest chapter in the book is Holyhead. And I have to admit that I'd passed through Holyhead. I'd been there once or twice. I'd actually sort of rather dismissed it, really, like lots of people do. And when you begin to look at it, you realise that, you know, a great many important people, live and dead, have passed through Holyhead. I love the story about Erskine Childers, who was actually running guns to Ireland on the Asgard, on a yacht. And on that trip, they'd actually, unfortunately, or maybe luckily, well, unfortunately, they'd found themselves in the middle of the English fleet off the southern coast of England. So they could have been caught, because obviously these were rifles that were clandestine. But anyway, he stopped off in Holyhead just before they went over the Irish coast. And I imagine this bit, but it is interesting that if you're someone who is about to walk into what is conceivably a moment of history, what do you do? Well, Erskine Childers went to have a haircut so he could look at his best for this moment. So there are lots of little things like that you come across. And I suppose the best thing I came across was based on a sort of thing I half remembered from many, many, many years ago. Someone told me that the lighthouse men around the Irish Sea used to conduct marathon chess games against each other. Right. So I just remembered that. I was thinking, oh, where did I get that from? Well, of course, when I was writing this book, it was during the lockdown, and I had to write a travel book the wrong way round, if you like. So normally I would go somewhere with my notebook, go to places, talk to people. But this time around, I couldn't go anywhere. So the second part of the process, which is to read a lot, and I normally give myself a set number of books, because I can't go on forever. So I normally say I'll read 60 books.
That's okay.
And I get a brand new bookcase and I gradually fill it with books I've read. So this occasion, all of the libraries and all the archives that would sometimes be a bit sort of difficult to access were all open because of the lockdown.
Yes.
And then I found in Ireland that there were archival records, interviews, long interviews, part of an oral history project where they interviewed lighthouse men, and the lighthouse men shared their accounts of playing chess against each other.
Wow.
If, you know, so we're talking via the, you know, magic of Zoom at the moment. But in the old days, you would telegraph things. So let's say you were in, you know, your lighthouse on the Fastnet, let's say, and I'm on the lighthouse on Bardsey Island. You've got the board in front of you, and then you actually telegraph your move to me. And I think, oh, that's clever. He's a really canny chess player.
Yeah.
But then I can take my time, because the point of the exercise isn't like a competition between grandmasters where they start the clock. This is to while away the hours.
It's it.
And you get to understand, you know, the tactics and all the rest of it. So the fact that I could find people actually explaining how important the books they were given, so they would be given in recent history, Guinness Book of Records and so on, things that would help them answer factual disputes. But I love that idea of people playing these games of chess, and that's a really strange sort of communion. And I suppose I wouldn't have been able to find that were it not for the unhappy circumstances of the lockdown. And finding that. So, yeah, the thing is, you know, you go into these subjects and, you know, you don't know much about it. And then you realise that there's so much out there. It could have been a book twice the size, really, because you write about the relationship of Wales and Ireland and the sort of exporting of Christianity. But we exported also Norman sailors from Pembrokeshire,
yes,
who actually went and domineered and changed the course of Irish history. So there's that thing as well. So we trade techniques in how to build graves in prehistoric times. We exchange actual physical goods and objects. But we also trade ideas. And those things, hopefully, when times are good, bring us closer.
I will never again take a ferry across the Irish Sea without thinking about things like this. It's been fascinating talking to you. It's a fabulous read. John Gower, author of The Turning Tide, a story basically about the Irish Sea. Just for listeners, I know that it's available in all good bookstores and it's available on websites, but our listeners can get their hands on it on our website, which is tre.radio. Julie has put that there so they can get their grubby little hands on it, and I hope they do in masses, John, because it's a lovely book, and it not just informs, but there's plenty of things that you can learn about and enjoy and smile about, and there are sad parts in it too, but it's really lovely, and congratulations and thanks for talking to us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I thought that would be appropriate following my conversation with John Gower. That's Anthony Graham and the song that's called The Irish Sea. Simple as that. Righty-ho, I enjoyed that. Aye. Righty, what am I to tell you? I have a lot to tell you, and I can't tell you all that I wanted to tell you because time is against me. But hospitality business owners have served up a warning to the government ahead of the general election. At a protest, restaurateurs, pub owners, childcare facility and beauty salon bosses were among those who marched to Leinster House from the Pepper Canister Church yesterday. Those who took to the podium spoke of the demise of family businesses and rural Ireland and their potential replacement with high street brands with globalist ambitions. One man warned that the only place you might end up finding an Irish pub is on the Costa del Sol. Aye, that mightn't even be owned by an Irish person. No VAT, no vote was the message. Hanging the hospitality industry out to dry was another. Don't let the high street die. And wake up government before it's too late, read some of the banners held by protesters. Among the first to speak was Paul Lenehan, a Kildare restaurateur and president of the Restaurants Association of Ireland, who was determined to make Buswell's political clientele pay attention. Enterprise Minister Peter Burke was singled out as an exception after backing them on their VAT demands. The upcoming general election will be pivotal to the future of our industry, Mr. Lenehan said. Now, the government is well aware that 270,000 people employed in hospitality and tourism, along with the hundreds and thousands more working in SMEs in our sectors, will all walk into voting booths across the country, possibly next month or the month after. If they want our support, he said, something has to change and something major. He called on Taoiseach Simon Harris and Finance Minister Jack Chambers to sit down with representative associations to hammer out meaningful policies to stabilise the cost of running small businesses. The crowd applauded as he read out each item on their wish list. It included demands for a reduction in VAT and excise duty, a review of the commercial rates system, recognition of the key role played by restaurants and pubs in Ireland's tourism offering, and a review of extra costs the government is adding now and in the coming years. If it did not cooperate, he said, businesses, jobs, livelihoods and the heart and soul of our communities will be lost. Hundreds of restaurants, pubs and small hospitality businesses have already closed, Mr. Lenehan said, and many more will follow. It's not because of a lack of support from customers or effort on their part, he added. It's because the cost of doing business has spiralled out of control and the government has refused to take meaningful action to address this. Many speakers insisted that they do not want handouts, but the reinstatement of the 9% VAT rate was one of the chief demands. Former politician Ivan Yates, who compared the event, said that it is not just the VAT rate that is at issue, but a 36% increase in payroll taxes, increases in the minimum wage, a new living wage, paid statutory sick leave and a new pension auto-enrolment scheme next September were among the policies described as having arrived virtually all at once, while businesses were already grappling with soaring energy costs and inflationary pressure. There is no doubt about it, but there is a huge amount of pressure on the small to medium-sized enterprises. And it's just unfortunate, I think, that restaurants and pubs and tourism outlets are at the core of that. And it's not helping that they have to increase their prices, because you heard myself and George Lee giving out last week about prices. But it's one of these things that they have to stay in business. And when they do that, then they lose custom. And then they get bad press because the prices are so high. Now, some are exorbitantly high, but they're shinshkelela, as they say. All right, have I got time for this? I haven't. I haven't got time for a whole lot, really, because everything else that I wanted to tell you needs to be delved into in a kind of a lengthy sort of a way. I suppose I should just say thank you to my two guests tonight on the programme, to John Evoy, who is the General Manager of Grow Remote. Thank you, John, and apologies that we had some issues, but we were able to get all of that interview broadcast, which was great. Thanks to, in some part, the technology that was able to allow me to continue with the chat with John Evoy and play it back to you when we had had things sorted out. John Gower, for talking to me about The Turning Tide, that lovely book. And as I said, it is available on our website at tre.radio. Thank you to Julie for making sure that that was put in place. I want to say thank you as well, as always, to our Spanish-Irish cultural advisor on the programme, Antonio Sierra, for his contribution to the programme on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, in fact, and the work that he does on it. And I suppose a special mention for Eamon, who might be home by now. I hope you are safe and sound. Thank you, Eamon, for sorting out the issues on the other side of the world in Spain when things did go awry. That's it for me. I hope that you have enjoyed listening to what I have put together for you. I certainly have enjoyed presenting it, and I look forward to your company next week between 7 and 9 for another Live On Era. Until then, from me, Ger Sweeney, bye-bye and thank you.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.